ocean-going ships could enter, and in many places the shallow coastal waterways have meant that large ships could not get near the shores. Ironically, for centuries, much of the world's international trade was carried in ships that sailed past West Africa on their way between Europe and Asia around the southern tip of the continent. Seldom did they stop. Partly this was a result of wind and ocean currents that made return trips between Europe and sub-Saharan Africa difficult or not economically feasible in the era of wind-driven ships, at least until far greater knowledge of those currents and of alternative routes developed. Relatively little of Africa's trade entered international commerce. In the era before the modern transportation revolution of railroads, automobiles, and planes, which is to say, throughout most of human history, the geographical barriers surrounding tropical Africa have been formidable, though not absolutely impenetrable. The consequences have been not only economic, but cultural. As the eminent French historian Fernand Braudel put it, "External influence filtered only very slowly, drop by drop, into the vast African continent south of the Sahara." The geographic barriers to economic and cultural exchanges within various regions of sub-Saharan Africa have been formidable as well. The most striking of these barriers has been a dearth of navigable rivers or streams, though the land itself also presents difficult terrain in many places in the form of escarpments and rift valleys. The net effect has been that the peoples of sub-Saharan Africa have historically been insulated not only from the peoples and cultures of the outside world, but also from one another. Among the cultural consequences has been a linguistic fragmentation of tropical Africa, which has made African languages one-third of all the languages in the world, even though African peoples are only about 10% of the world's population. This linguistic fragmentation has been only one aspect of cultural fragmentation in general, including tribalism and many religious differences. In much of sub-Saharan Africa, a combination of geographic features has had unfavorable, if not devastating, consequences for economic and cultural development, and tragic consequences for the vulnerability of black Africans to outside conquerors. The natural environment. One of the remarkable facts about the African continent is that, despite being much larger than the continent of Europe, its coastline is shorter than the European coastline, indeed, shorter than the coastline of any other continent, even though Africa is second only to Asia in size. This anomaly reflects Africa's lack of the numerous coastal indentations which form natural harbors in Europe, providing places where ships can dock, sheltered from the rough waters of the open seas, thereby enabling European countries to become maritime nations early in their history. In addition to a dearth of harbors, parts of sub-Saharan Africa have shallow coastal waters, so that maritime trade has often had to be conducted by the costly method of having ships anchor offshore, with their cargoes being unloaded onto smaller vessels, which could then make their way to land through these shallow waters. Africans have generally not been seafaring peoples, except in the Mediterranean, or in parts of East Africa where these geographic constraints have not been as severe. Much of Africa, and especially sub-Saharan Africa, has developed without the benefits of a large maritime trade and the consequent stimulus of economic and cultural interchanges on a large scale with various and disparate peoples. While there has been for centuries some trade between sub-Saharan Africa and Europe, or with the peoples of North Africa and the Middle East, international trade has generally played a relatively smaller part in the total trade of Africa as compared to other continents, not only because of a dearth of harbors, but also because of a dearth of navigable rivers reaching into the interior of the continent from the sea. River mouths opening into the sea have been blocked by sandbars in some places, and in other places the few good harbors have been connected to hinterlands that were not very productive, and so have had little to offer in trade. Thin coastal plains, averaging only 20 miles in width and often backed by steep escarpments, have likewise provided little basis for large-scale international trade, even where other conditions might permit it. Low and irregular rainfall over many parts of Africa fill rivers and streams to a navigable depth only intermittently, and even when filled, many rivers and streams are navigable only by smaller boats or barges, not ocean-going vessels. Where the volume of water is sufficient for navigation by sizable vessels, the many rapids and waterfalls of Africa still impede international trade. The Zaire River, for example, is 2,900 miles long and has a volume of water second only to that of the Amazon, but its rapids and waterfalls near the sea prevent ocean-going ships from reaching inland. Thus, the role played by other great rivers of the world in facilitating the development of ports that became great cities, contributing to the economic and cultural development of the surrounding lands and peoples, was denied the Zaire by the intractable facts of geography. Nor is the Zaire unique among Africa's rivers. No river in sub-Saharan Africa reaches from the open sea to deep into the interior. On the Mediterranean coast, only the Nile reaches far inland. Significantly, the Nile spawned the most famous of the civilizations developed on the African continent, as well as the two largest cities on the continent, Cairo and Alexandria. Except for the Nile, Africa's rivers that are even seasonally navigable tend to be concentrated in equatorial West Africa, which has produced larger and more advanced societies than in many other tropical regions of the continent. In short, the peoples of Africa, like the peoples of Europe and Asia, tended to develop urban centers and larger cultural universes around navigable waterways. There have simply been far fewer of them in Africa, which has been and remains the world's least urbanized continent. Among the relatively few things which have had sufficiently concentrated value in a relatively small physical size so as to be able to repay the high costs of transport from Africa have historically been gold, ivory, and slaves. All three became major exports. The coast of what is now Nigeria became known as the Slave Coast, just as the coast of neighboring Ghana to the west was called the Gold Coast, and that west of Ghana was, and still is, called the Ivory Coast. One indicator of differences in access to waterways is that, while more than a third of Europe's landmass consists of islands and peninsulas, only 2% of Africa's landmass consists of islands and peninsulas. Such disparities in access to waterways are accentuated when the navigability of these waterways is also taken into account. Even the Niger River, the heart of a great river system in West Africa, draining an area nearly twice the size of Texas, is not navigable everywhere by large vessels, and is not navigable at all in some places because of rapids. At the height of the rainy season, the Niger may become a 20-mile-wide moving lake, but during the dry season, the average depth of the Niger can in places fall below 4 meters. Despite its serious limitations, the Niger compares favorably with other African rivers with even more serious limitations. The Niger has been characterized as the easiest to navigate in all of tropical Africa. Navigating the Niger's chief tributary, the Benue River, for example, has been more problematical. Because of seasonal rainfall patterns, the upper Benue has been navigable only 2 months of the year, leading to hectic and complicated shipping patterns. If they let the craft stay up the Benue a day too long, the vessels will be stuck on sandbars for 10 months. Yet if through caution or misinformation they withdraw the fleet too soon, much valuable merchandise is left behind and can only be evacuated by land at much greater cost. The first boats to go in are the commercial canoes, then follow the larger craft, and finally, when there is sufficient water at Lokoja, the largest power craft and their barges sail up the river as fast as possible. Towards the end of the short season, the large craft have to come out first because of the fall in the level of the water. The medium-sized craft follow, and the small canoes may continue for some time evacuating small quantities of produce. Drastic changes in water levels are common in other West African rivers and streams. The Senegal River has been characterized as precariously navigable, and only during some months at that. Like the Niger, the Senegal is not only subject to large seasonal changes in water flow, but also contains rocks and rapids. In East Africa, such rivers as the Zambezi are navigable only for relatively short stretches. One reason for the drastic seasonal changes in water levels in African rivers is that tropical Africa is one of the few large regions of the world without a single mountain range to collect snow, whose later melting would supplement rainfall in maintaining the flow of streams and rivers. Rivers in tropical Africa are wholly dependent on rainfall, and that rainfall is itself highly undependable, not only from one season to another, but also from one year to the next. The term navigable can, of course, mean many things. In some of the rivers of Angola, for example, it means navigable by boats requiring no more than 8 feet of water, and in parts of West Africa during the dry season, even the Niger will carry barges weighing no more than 8 tons. By contrast, ships weighing 10,000 tons can go hundreds of miles up the Yangtze River in China, and smaller vessels another 1,000 miles beyond that. Aircraft carriers can go up the Hudson River and dock at a pier in mid-Manhattan. Navigable rivers in Africa seldom mean anything approaching that. Even the Nile was unable to handle the largest vessels in Roman times. Moreover, because so much of tropical Africa consists of high plateaus, almost the entire continent is more than 1,000 feet above sea level, and half the continent is more than 2,500 feet above sea level, African rivers must plunge greater vertical distances to reach the sea, making them less navigable en route. While the Amazon River falls only about 20 feet during its last 500 miles to the sea, the Zaire River drops about 1,000 feet in 250 miles as it approaches the sea. As a geographer has put it, the African continent is cursed with a mesa form which converts nearly every river into a plunging torrent. However impenetrable much of the interior of sub-Saharan Africa may have been to large ocean-going ships, the continent's coastal waters have been plied by smaller boats, which could and did go inland as well, being unloaded and carried around waterfalls. Shipments from ocean-going vessels could also be loaded onto smaller craft for transportation into the interior on rivers. Local waterborne traffic between inland locations was likewise possible by carrying boats and their cargoes around rapids and waterfalls. Sometimes these boats and cargoes were carried from one river to another, thereby expanding the reach of commerce. For example, an overland route requiring 25 days of porterage on land connected the Niger and the Senegal rivers in centuries past. Moreover, even rivers beset with cascades and waterfalls may have navigable stretches that add up to considerable distances, hundreds of miles on the Senegal and more than 1,500 on the Zaire, even though these are not continuous distances. Thus, the various regions of Africa were not hermetically sealed off from one another or from the outside world, but both the volume and the variety of trade, as well as the distances involved, were nevertheless severely curtailed in comparison with more geographically fortunate regions of the world, where heavy and bulky cargoes of coal, ores, and grain could be shipped long distances in continuous river and ocean voyages. A late 20th century comparison of the transportation costs of grain in several Asian and African nations found that these transport costs were a higher proportion of the total price paid for grain by consumers in Africa. Moreover, such statistics do not capture the effect of transport costs on grain that was never shipped in the first place, precisely because higher shipping costs would have made it prohibitively expensive. Contemporary transport costs also cannot capture the handicaps created by even higher transport costs in Africa before many of the transportation advances from the rest of the world were introduced in the 19th and early 20th centuries, and before African harbors could be dredged by modern European equipment and Western railroads built. While it is true, as an historian has said, that a considerable portion of West Africa was part of a hydrographic system that was ultimately connected to the Atlantic, the limitations of that system are a part of the story that cannot be omitted without serious distortion. Moreover, the distances between the interior hinterlands and the open seas are greater in Africa than in Europe, for example, while the means of covering those distances are much more limited by geography in Africa. In Europe, no part of the continent outside of Russia is more than 500 miles from the sea, but a substantial part of tropical Africa is more than 500 miles from the sea, and a portion is more than 1,000 miles from the sea. Only Asia has a larger interior area remote from the sea, though Asia has more navigable rivers connecting its interior with the coast. The geographical positions of African rivers must also be taken into account. Although the Niger River originates just 200 miles from the Atlantic Ocean, it circles far inland before eventually turning back toward the sea and covers 2,600 miles before actually reaching the ocean. In general, the tenuous connection of the African interior with the sea has been one of the major geographical barriers to the economic, cultural, and political development of the continent south of the Sahara. Land transportation in large regions of sub-Saharan Africa has also been made more difficult because of the prevalence of the tsetse fly, which has carried a fatal sickness that has affected animals as well as human beings and made the use of pack animals and draft animals impracticable in many places. Denied this aid to land transportation, Africans often carried bundles on their heads in colorful caravans that were reflections of the bleak alternatives left to them without the help of either the waterways or the animal power available to other peoples on other continents. Expensive transportation provided by human beings limited what could be carried, how far it could be carried, and how fast. In addition to the physical limitations, there were narrower limits imposed by economics as to what items contained enough value in a relatively small space to repay the costs of this expensive method of transport. The lack of animals' muscle power in tropical Africa has been felt not only in transportation, but also in farming. A dearth of draft animals in farming often meant not only a loss of muscle power, but also a dearth of fertilizer. The latter has been especially important in those parts of the continent where soils have been very much in need of fertilizer because their low nutrient content and proneness to erosion meant that their fertility was easily exhausted by cultivation. Rainfall patterns in parts of Africa, long dry spells followed by torrential downpours, increase erosion since dry, baked soil is more easily washed away. Moreover, these torrential tropical downpours tend to leach the nutrients from the soil in Africa, as in many other tropical regions. Finally, the tropics provide a disease environment in which many more deadly diseases may flourish than in temperate zones, or in mountainous tropical regions that have more temperate climates because of their heights. For example, 90% of all deaths from malaria in the world occur in sub-Saharan Africa. Even a listing of individual geographical disadvantages in Africa may understate the handicap they represent in combination. For example, the problem of poor water transportation, while serious in itself, is still more serious in combination with poor land transportation across much difficult terrain without the aid of pack animals. The highly variable rainfall patterns become more serious in view of where the rain falls. A geographical study of Africa found plenty of water available where it cannot be used, and a scarcity where it is most needed. Not all parts of sub-Saharan Africa have suffered all these disabilities simultaneously. However, the fragile fertility in some regions of tropical Africa has meant that a given territory would not permanently feed people at a given location, and this in turn meant that those people had to move on every few years to find new land that would feed them, while the land they left behind recovered its fertility. Therefore, whole societies had to be mobile, foregoing the opportunities to build territorially based communities with permanent structures, such as other Africans built in more geographically favored parts of the continent, and which were common in Europe, Asia, and the Western Hemisphere. The provincialism of isolated peoples has not been peculiar to Africa. What has been peculiar to Africa are the geographic barriers to mobility that have pervaded vast areas below the Sahara. Waterways extend the boundaries of cultural interchange, but in much of sub-Saharan Africa, they did not extend those cultural boundaries very far. Like other places relatively isolated from broader cultural developments, the Scottish Highlands, parts of the Balkans, or the South Sea Islands, for example, much of sub-Saharan Africa tended to lag behind the technological, organizational, and economic progress in other parts of the world. A lack of literacy throughout most of sub-Saharan Africa further limited both internal development and the stimulus of contacts with distant times and places via the written word. While similar retardation afflicted particular parts of Europe or Asia, or isolated island communities around the world, in Africa, such cultural isolation characterized wide areas and many peoples. The degree of these cultural handicaps has varied in different parts of the continent and has changed over time. Railroads, motor transport, and airplanes have all added to transportation possibilities, and electronic communication media, from cheap radios to television, have penetrated cultural isolation. But all this has happened within a recent, minute fraction of human history, long after great cultural differences had developed among peoples with geographically restricted cultures and between them and others with more ample access to wider cultural worlds. Moreover, even in modern times, the sharp changes in altitude of the African landscape continued to make both roads and railroads difficult to build. The rail line from Djibouti to Addis Ababa, for example, rises more than 2,000 feet in its first 60 miles and more than 4,600 feet in its last 180 miles. Given the multiple and formidable geographical obstacles to its economic and cultural development, Africa's poverty is hardly surprising. This poverty, over much of sub-Saharan Africa, is shown in many ways. Lower incomes per capita are an obvious indicator, though the complexities of international exchange rates make these statistics questionable as measures of relative standards of living. However, when the monetary value of output per capita in Nigeria is less than 2% of that in the United States, and in Tanzania less than 1%, that clearly cannot all be due to exchange rates. A more meaningful picture of differences in living standards is that average life expectancies are typically more than 70 years in Europe, Australia, the United States, Canada, and Japan, while average life expectancies in sub-Saharan Africa tend to be in the 50s or even the 40s. Moreover, even these life expectancies in Africa have been achieved only with the help of medical and public health measures originating elsewhere in the world. Within this general picture of lagging economic development in much of Africa, there have been historic and continuing variations in economic development and political organization among the various regions of the continent. One of the more fortunate regions of sub-Saharan Africa, from various perspectives, has been Equatorial West Africa, what is today Nigeria, Ghana, and their neighboring states. This region has some of the continent's more fertile soil, ample rainfall, and the Niger River system. Here, some of the larger African kingdoms arose. However, even in this relatively more favored region of Africa, the states and even empires that arose were often small by world standards. The Oyo Empire, in what is today Nigeria, covered an estimated 150,000 square kilometers, which is smaller than the American state of Colorado. The Songhai Empire, which included the rich river valleys of the central and western Sudan, was about the size of France, which is to say, smaller than Texas. Yet these were huge states by African standards, since most Africans lived in polities only a fraction as large, with national populations no larger than the population of cities or even towns in the rest of the world. In Africa, as in other parts of the world, those peoples who were more fortunate often used their advantages to subjugate others. In West Africa, this subjugation took the form both of conquest and of enslavement of fellow Africans. Across the Sahara, in North Africa, more favorable geographic conditions, including harbors on the Mediterranean, also led to larger and more advanced societies. These, too, used their advantages to subjugate and enslave sub-Saharan Africans. In East Africa, some of the more geographically favored areas included harbors, such as the large natural harbor on the offshore island of Zanzibar and such mainland ports as Mombasa and Kilwa. All three became major centers for the trading and shipment of slaves, usually captured from less fortunate inland tribes. Here, the enslavers were typically either Arabs or people of mixed Arab and African ancestry and culture, known as Swahilis. The geography of Eastern and Western Europe. Among the geographic advantages of Western Europe lacking in Eastern Europe has been ready access to the oceans of the world. While no point in Western Europe is more than 350 kilometers from the sea, there are parts of Eastern Europe more than 1,000 kilometers from the sea. The warming influence of the Gulf Stream, which moderates the winters in Western Europe, making them much milder than at corresponding latitudes in Asia or North America, is felt less and less to the east, where the continental climate is more bitterly cold in winter and the rivers are frozen for longer periods of time than the rivers of Western Europe. The Baltic Sea is likewise frozen for months at a time. In the Balkans, the mild, subtropical air of the Mediterranean is blocked off by mountain ranges from reaching much of eastern and southeastern Europe, including the hinterlands of the Dalmatian coast. Because of the isolating effect of coastal mountains along the Adriatic shore, winter temperatures inland in Sarajevo may be nearly 50 degrees colder than on the coast, little more than 100 miles away. Many of the rivers of Eastern Europe flow into lakes or inland seas, rather than out into the open waters of the oceans, with their international trade routes, so that the benefits of low-cost access by water to the markets of the world, and the ideas of the world, have historically been far less available in the eastern part of the continent. In the rugged lands of the Balkans, largely lacking navigable rivers and cut off from access to the coast by mountains that come down close to the shore, it has been estimated that in Ottoman times, the cost of shipping wheat overland just 100 kilometers exceeded the value of the wheat itself. The painful economic implications of such high transport costs extended well beyond wheat to commerce and industry in general, and also help explain the cultural insularity which long plagued the region. While Western European nations became the center of trade networks that reached all parts of the world, much of Eastern Europe, and especially the Balkans, remained regions of self-sufficiency, which is to say, isolation, backwardness, and poverty. What foreign trade they had was based on supplying raw materials such as wool, grain, and lumber to Western European nations from whom they bought manufactured goods. Climate and soil are also less favorable in the Balkans, which lacks the more consistent rainfall and more fertile soils of northwestern Europe. The fact that land capable of supporting human life often occurs in isolated patches in mountain valleys has meant that Balkan settlements have often developed in isolation from one another, as well as from the outside world. For Russia, the colder winter climate of Eastern Europe, compared to Western Europe, means that, although the country has an abundance of rivers, those rivers are not abundantly available for use the year round, nor are the northern seaports, which are likewise frozen a substantial part of the year. Russia's warmer southern ports on the Black Sea have had to connect to the outside world through the narrow straits of the Bosphorus and the Dardanelles, controlled by the Turks and by the Byzantines before them. Only after an 1829 treaty were Russian ships allowed through these straits, thus making large-scale grain shipments from Russia economically feasible. The difference that this made is indicated by the fact that Russian grain could then undersell Croatian grain on the Dalmatian coast, since the Russian grain was shipped at low cost by water and the Croatian grain by land, even though the latter was shipped for shorter distances. While many of the Slavic lands lack the natural resource abundance of Western Europe, Russia's rich deposits of coal, oil, and other resources make it one of the most fortunate countries of the world in that regard. However, only relatively recently in its history have Russia's human resources allowed it to realize much of the potential of its natural resources, for, as late as the end of the 19th century, the vast majority of Russians were still illiterate. As in other regions of the world, physical resources alone have meant little when the complementary human capital was missing. The geography of the Western Hemisphere. While, in narrowly physical terms, the lands and waters of the Western Hemisphere were the same for the indigenous peoples as they would later be for the transplanted populations from Europe, the complete absence of horses, oxen, cattle, and sheep in the Western Hemisphere before the arrival of the Europeans was momentous in its implications for food supply in general, agriculture in particular, and above all, for the size of the cultural universe available to any given Indian tribe, nation, or civilization. Horses and camels made the Silk Road a highway stretching thousands of miles across the Eurasian landmass to connect China with Europe. But nothing comparable was possible in the Western Hemisphere to connect the Iroquois on the Atlantic seaboard of North America with the Aztecs of Central America. Italians could acquire spaghetti from China, but the Iroquois could acquire nothing from the Aztecs, or even be aware of their existence. Agriculture in the Western Hemisphere was inherently limited to what could be accomplished without animal muscle power to carry or to pull loads or to plow the land, as well as to supply manure to maintain the fertility of farms. Land transport in general was obviously severely limited in the loads and the distances that were possible without animals. Even the navigable waterways were limited in their capacities to move cargo by the absence of pack animals and draft animals to transport these cargoes when they reached land. Indian canoes plied the inland and coastal waterways of the hemisphere long before the white man arrived, but larger vessels with greater cargo capacity would have exceeded the severe physical and economic limits of a land without the kinds of animals needed to make larger cargoes economically viable. Llamas were available as pack animals in limited regions of South America, and dogs were used by Eskimos and by some North American Plains Indians to pull loads, but these animals did not compare with horses or oxen in what they could transport. As in much of sub-Saharan Africa, not only were loads and distances limited physically in the Western Hemisphere by an absence of the needed animals, the particular kinds of things that would be economically feasible to trade at considerable distances were even more limited economically to those things whose concentrated value could repay high transport costs, often involving human porters. Tons of grain, for example, could be shipped for hundreds of miles in Europe, but not in the Western Hemisphere before the Europeans arrived and brought pack animals and draft animals. Even in those regions of the Western Hemisphere that had networks of waterways comparable to those in Western Europe, limitations on land transport limited cargoes transported by water. Moreover, limitations on the scope and range of trade were also limitations on the scope and range of cultural interchanges. Specific geographic barriers, the Amazon jungle, the Rocky Mountains, or the vast desert in what is today the southwestern United States, were of course major barriers to large-scale cultural interactions in pre-Columbian times, but the absence of animals for transport was a more general barrier to long-range cultural interactions throughout the Americas. While these barriers were not as severe as the geographic barriers in parts of sub-Saharan Africa, they were more formidable than those in much of Europe and Asia. The absence of herd animals, like sheep and cattle, as well as the absence of load-bearing or load-pulling animals, like horses and oxen, had another consequence. An absence of the many diseases carried by such animals and often acquired by human beings living in close proximity with these animals. While, in one sense, the absence of such diseases was of course a benefit, their absence also meant an absence of biological resistance to many potentially devastating diseases, such as smallpox. So long as such diseases did not exist in the Western Hemisphere, the Indians' lack of biological resistance to them was of no consequence. But, once people from Europe began arriving with these diseases, the consequences were momentous, not only for those indigenous populations stricken and devastated by these diseases at the time, but also for the historic transfer of North and South America from the indigenous peoples to the European invaders. The most invincible of these invaders proved to be not the Europeans themselves, but the invisible carriers of their diseases, whose existence neither they nor the Indians suspected. The fact that the Eurasian landmass stretches predominantly east and west, while the Western Hemisphere landmasses stretch predominantly north and south, means that advances in agriculture and animal husbandry could spread more readily over far more vast distances in the Old World than in the New. Plants and animals are more similar in the same latitudes, while more drastic climate changes accompany north-south movement. Thus, rice cultivation could spread across Asia to Europe and ultimately to North America, but bananas could not spread from Central America to Canada. Nor could many of the animals adapted to the tropics survive in the colder climates to the north or south, so that knowledge of how to hunt or domesticate these animals was similarly restricted in how far it would be applicable, even if such knowledge could be transmitted over long distances. Moreover, the northern temperate zone and the southern temperate zone of the Western Hemisphere were too far apart to make any sharing of knowledge between them feasible in pre-Columbian times. In short, climate, like other aspects of geography, limited the size of the cultural universes of the indigenous peoples of the Western Hemisphere. The geographical environment of the Western Hemisphere itself changed with the European conquest. Vast herds of new animals were transplanted from Europe, along with the invisible transplanting of a whole new disease environment and a whole new technology from Europe. These transplantations changed the lives of the indigenous peoples, as well as allowing the European settlers to bring much of their cultural world to the Americas. Mounted Indian warriors with herds of cattle became a traditional way of life on the western plains of the United States, for example, while the gauchos who herded cattle for Spanish landowners on the Argentina Pampas were often part or full-blooded Indians as well. Such physical features of the Western Hemisphere as natural harbors and rivers reaching deep inland from the sea now became far more important economically after the arrival of white invaders and settlers in ships developed in Europe, but better adapted to exploit New World conditions than were the canoes of the Indians. Those parts of the Western Hemisphere most highly developed by the Europeans were not the same as those that had been most highly developed by the indigenous peoples. Whereas the most advanced Indian civilizations developed in Central America and in the Andes Mountains, the most advanced regions developed by Europeans were those regions whose geography was most like that of Western Europe, places with natural harbors and broad coastal plains, crisscrossed by rivers deep enough to carry large ships, and eventually, places with the mineral deposits needed to build an industrial society. Only in the narrowest physical sense was the geographic setting of the Western Hemisphere the same for the indigenous peoples and for the Europeans. The flora, the fauna, and the disease environments were changed radically, and the natural features of the land and the waters acquired a much wider range of possibilities as a result of this, as well as because of the new technology brought from Europe. Moreover, the technology that the Europeans brought to the Western Hemisphere was not simply the technology of Europe. Because of the geography of the Eurasian landmass, Europeans were able to bring to bear in the Western Hemisphere the cultural features of lands extending far beyond Europe, but incorporated into their civilization. Europeans were able to cross the Atlantic Ocean in the first place because they could steer with rudders invented in China, calculate their position on the open sea through trigonometry invented in Egypt using numbers created in India. The knowledge they had accumulated from around the world was preserved in letters invented by the Romans and written on paper invented in China. The military power they brought with them increasingly depended on weapons using gunpowder, also invented in Asia. The cultural confrontation in the Western Hemisphere was, in effect, a one-sided struggle between cultures acquired from vast regions of the Earth against cultures from much more narrowly circumscribed regions of the New World. Never have the advantages of a wider cultural universe been more dramatically or more devastatingly demonstrated than in the conquests that followed. Educational issues. Tragicomic educators. American education would be comic if it were not so tragic in its consequences. Recently, I received a letter from a school teacher asking for an autographed picture for his class because it would ultimately, ultimately, help his students to have me as a role model, ROLL. Atypical? Let us hope so. But a few years ago, a study showed the average verbal scholastic aptitude test score for aspiring teachers to be 389 out of a possible 800. With American schoolchildren repeatedly finishing at or near the bottom on international test comparisons, the response of the education establishment has been to seek ever more non-academic adventures to go off on. Among the latest of these innovations, a magic word in the wonderland of educational newspeak, is called outcome-based education. Like so many of the catchphrases that come and go, it means nothing like what it seems to mean. Education based on outcomes might sound to many people like finally creating a bottom line for schools, teachers, and administrators to be judged by. Nothing of the sort. It is yet another way of getting away from academic work and indulging in psychological and ideological indoctrination. This is called advancing beyond rote learning and teaching schoolchildren to think. Many in the media gullibly repeat such phrases without the slightest investigation of what concretely they mean in practice. When concrete specifics leak out, there is often shock, as there currently is in California, where tests are intruding into students' family lives and sexual experiences, among other things. The parents who first protested were predictably labeled the religious right, but now even some in the educational establishment itself have begun to express concern. Not long before, parents in Connecticut who objected to film strips of naked couples engaged in sex, both homosexual and heterosexual, being shown in the local junior high school were labeled fundamentalists and right-wing extremists, even though they were in fact affluent Episcopalians. There are all sorts of prepackaged responses to critics of the public schools, of which this was just one. Recently, I got a first-hand dose of these stereotyped responses when addressing a class of students who are being trained for careers as teachers. They seemed disconcerted by the questions I put to them. Suppose you are wrong. How would you know? How would you test for that possibility? The very thought that the dogmas they were repeating with such fervor might be open to question or subject to evidence seemed never to have occurred to them. This was a far more ominous sign than their merely being wrong on particular beliefs. How can they teach anybody else to think if they themselves have not reached this elementary level of logic? By thinking, too many educators today mean teaching children to reject traditions in favor of their own emotional responses. Objections to such propaganda programs are called objections to letting children think. Anything less than a blank check for indoctrination is called censorship. In light of such non-academic activities in our public schools, it can hardly be surprising that American youngsters do so badly on academic tests administered to youngsters around the world. Nor is it surprising that academic work is so readily abandoned for social experiments, ideological crusades, and psychological manipulations by educators whose own academic performances have long been shown to be substandard. It is not uncommon for those few schools with traditional academic programs to have waiting lists of parents who want to get their children admitted. When admission is on a first-come, first-served basis, it is not uncommon for parents to camp out overnight in hopes of getting their children into institutions that will teach them substance instead of fluff and politically correct propaganda. Against this background, recent campaigns for a longer school day and a longer school year are farcical. If a lack of time is the problem, why are schools wasting so much time on innumerable non-academic activities? Moreover, there is no amount of additional time that cannot be wasted on similar pursuits. No small part of the existing problems of the public schools is that the school day is already so long and boring, with so little to challenge the ablest students. Moreover, many average and below-average students who have lost all interest are retained by compulsory attendance laws for years past the point where their presence is accomplishing anything other than providing jobs for educators. Despite orchestrated hysteria about the dropout problem, what many apathetic students most need is a cold dose of reality that they can only get out in the workaday world, not in the never-never land of the public schools. Scientists need not apply. It wasn't really news when American high school seniors came in at or near the bottom in recent international math and science tests, but many newspapers gave it headlines. The real story, however, is that three distinguished American scientists, one a Nobel laureate, offered to help design California's new science curriculum last fall, and their offer was rejected. What this little episode shows is that creating a curriculum in our public schools is not about getting children educated. It is about doing things that teachers like and can handle. The last thing they want is a science curriculum designed by somebody with a Nobel Prize. First of all, the education establishment is not about to give up any part of its turf, much less require its teachers to try to do things that many of them are simply not capable of doing. Anyone familiar with the dismal test scores of students who take education courses knows that it is utopian to expect such people to turn out students able to stand up to international competition in mathematics and science. The kinds of people who come out of departments and schools of education need a curriculum focused on non-academic activities and goals that make them feel good and feel important. Social engineering, indoctrinating students with trendy attitudes, and enrolling them in various crusades for environmentalism and public service projects fill that bill. Teaching kids about the square on the hypotenuse is not where it's at, as far as these kinds of teachers are concerned. It is unreasonable, almost cruel, to expect them to play that role. If that role needs to be played, and it definitely does, then we need to get different people teaching in our public schools. Without that, everything else is cosmetics and pouring more money down a bottomless pit. Where are we to find these new people? They are everywhere. Private schools find them in such abundance that people with solid educations, but often without education courses, can be hired at lower salaries than the public schools pay. Elaborate restrictions on entry to the public schools are necessary to protect existing teachers from their competition. The National Education Association may make a lot of noise about not wanting unqualified people in the classrooms, but this is newspeak. What they mean by unqualified are people who have not jumped through the hoops of the education schools and education departments. Nobel Prize winners are unqualified by this definition. Our public schools have not failed. They have succeeded incredibly in carrying out their own agenda, wholly at cross purposes with the goals of those who pay the bills and those who send their children to them to be educated. Every demand for better results is turned into a demand for more money. Every failure is blamed on parents, television, society. The greatest success of the educators has been in keeping their own performance off the agenda, the rewards wholly unrelated to classroom performance, and sanctions virtually nil in a tenure system where firing one teacher can cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. At no point does the education establishment have to put up or shut up. In even the worst of the worst schools, typically in low-income and minority neighborhoods, the teachers' unions bitterly oppose letting even a fraction of the students go to private schools with vouchers. This is not caprice or racism. It is naked self-interest. The whole house of cards could come tumbling down if the failing students from ghetto schools go elsewhere and succeed. Various studies have already shown that happening. But studies are for scholars and policy wonks. what would be politically devastating would be to have millions of people all across America seeing it with their own eyes. This is only one area where preventing lofty rhetoric from being put to empirical tests is crucial for the education establishment. Federal money plays a key role in this. This money and the controls that go with it mean that whole language, whole math, bilingual education, and the rest of the trendy agenda can be mandated from Washington so that what results they produce will simply not matter. The survival of the existing system depends on results not mattering. Higher Education and Low Comedy. If you liked Alice in Wonderland, you will love The Chronicle of Higher Education, the trade publication of academia. Just one issue, dated the 13th of October 1993, for those who are superstitious, contains stories about professors that make you wonder if academics ever grow up. In that issue, New York University advertised for a faculty member in the performing arts for what it called gendered performance. The specific duties of the job include drag, transvestite performance, queer theories. The university encourages applications from women and members of minority groups. None of the usual stuff about being an equal opportunity affirmative action employer that we have grown so used to that its internal contradictions no longer bother us. In what literally became a federal case, a professor at the University of Alabama injected his religious views into a physical exercise class that he taught. When the university told him to stop it, he sued. Eventually, he lost the case but gained tenure, so perhaps it was a standoff. Had he injected left-wing ideologies into wholly unrelated subjects like biology or English, as happens routinely on many campuses across the country, he would never even have been warned. Another federal case arose because a professor who cussed out his students in class ignored warnings to stop it and then sued when he was eventually fired. This case went as far as the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, where the prof lost. This does not mean that mere profanity in the classroom is grounds for firing a professor. It was only the fact that the profanity was directed against students that got the professor in trouble. All across the country, and all up and down the academic pecking order from Harvard to Podunk A&M, four-letter words are okay in the classroom under the broad umbrella of academic freedom. Professors who go to bed with their students are also covered by academic freedom, even if they are not covered by anything else. The same issue of the Chronicle of Higher Education includes letters from readers responding to an essay by a professor at the University of Massachusetts who says that he has remedied the problem of female students whose virginity was unnaturally prolonged. Again, we need have no fear for this professor's job, either for his actions or his subsequent boasts about them. It is very unlikely that his deflowering of student virgins will add to the congestion of the federal courts. At Stanford, incidentally, male students can get into all kinds of trouble under a new and vaguely worded sexual harassment code, but Stanford professors who go to bed with their students are merely admonished. Mob rule is also alive and well in academia. The same issue of the Chronicle of Higher Education reports on a riot at UCLA in which students attacked the faculty club. They broke the club's plate glass windows, wrecked furniture, and carved graffiti in its walls. In due course, they were rewarded by the UCLA administration's promise to add two new professors in Chicano studies and to exempt ethnic studies programs from any of the cutbacks that might hit such non-relevant subjects as mathematics or economics. The Chronicle also reported on similar events at Berkeley. Several hundred protesters ran through two campus buildings and pulled fire alarms. No one was arrested. Note that protesters is the politically correct term for rioters, vandals, or stormtroopers on campus. Although these protesters are routinely reported as expressing their rage or their anguish, One of the Cornell student leaders may have captured the real spirit more accurately when he said, after various organized acts of vandalism there, "This is very exciting." One of the reasons we don't hear much about such campus outbursts in the general media, the way we did back in the 1960s, is that they happen too often to be news and are accepted too supinely to have the drama of conflict. Experienced academic administrators have also learned how to minimize the number of such episodes by various techniques of preemptive surrender. By staying constantly aware of what is most likely to set off the most volatile elements among the students and faculty, administrators know which way to bend academic policy and whose misconduct or outright crimes are to be overlooked. This game works only because many outside of academia are not even aware that the game is being played. But before deciding whether to contribute to dear old alma mater, it might be well worthwhile to subscribe to the Chronicle of Higher Education. You could end up deciding to donate to medical research instead, or to invest the money in the marketplace, where it will help create jobs. Success concealing failure. Among the many clever and misleading defenses of our failing educational system is the assertion that our universities are among the highest rated in the world, and Americans consistently win a disproportionate number of Nobel Prizes. Both these claims are accurate and irrelevant. While Americans won the lion's share of Nobel Prizes in 1999, not one of these winners was actually born in the United States. If people born and raised elsewhere choose to come here and use their talents, fine. But do not claim their achievements as some vindication of the American educational system. On the contrary, the painful question must be faced. Why were a quarter of a billion native-born Americans unable to win a single Nobel Prize in 1999, when a relative handful of naturalized Americans won so many? This is not a vindication, but an indictment of our educational system. The top-rated American universities owe much to the generosity of American donors and the largesse of the American government, which enable them to attract top scholars from around the world. It is research, rather than teaching, which determines world rankings, and our well-financed PhD-granting universities are unquestionably among the best at research. However, when you look at who gets degrees in what, again, the picture is very disturbing as regards the track record of the schools and colleges that prepare students to enter these top-rated institutions. Less than half the PhDs in engineering and mathematics awarded by American universities are received by Americans. Even more revealing, there is a systematic relationship between the difficulty of the subject and the percentage of American doctorates which go to Americans. In a mushy and undemanding field like education, more than 4 out of 5 of the doctorates go to Americans. It is when you start getting into the physical sciences that the proportion drops to barely half, and when you get into engineering and math that Americans become a minority among American university PhDs. Foreign graduate students predominate so heavily in difficult subjects that a common complaint across the country is that undergraduate math courses are being taught by people whose English is hard to understand, quite aside from the difficulty of learning the subject itself. Yes, our top universities are the cream of the crop. They are so good that people educated in American schools and colleges cannot hold their own with foreign students who go there. The period during which American public schools have had declining test scores has coincided with the period during which Americans were increasingly displaced by foreigners in the graduate programs of our top universities. In every field surveyed by the Council of Graduate Schools, the proportion of graduate degrees in the United States going to Americans has declined over a period of 2 decades, with the worst declines being in the more demanding subjects. A closer look at those Americans who do still hold their own in difficult fields is also revealing. Nearly 22% of all PhDs in engineering received by Americans are received by Asian Americans. Here is the group that is most out of step with the prevailing easygoing education, with its emphasis on self-esteem and other mushy fads. Again, this is not a vindication, but an indictment of what is being done in our public schools. Ironically, people who go ballistic when minorities are underrepresented relative to their percentage of the population, whether among college degree recipients or in various professions, remain strangely silent when the whole American population is underrepresented among those receiving postgraduate degrees in science, math, and engineering in their own country. Such underrepresentation might be understandable if the United States were some third-world country just entering the world of modern science and technology. It is staggering in a country whose people led the world in such things in the recent past. Clearly, something has gone very wrong in our educational system. Our current world leadership in science and technology, like our leadership in Nobel Prizes, owes much to people who never went through the dumbed-down education in American schools and colleges. Many come from countries which spend far less per pupil than we do, but get far better results for their money. Public service or disservice? According to one of the college guides, students taking English 6 at Amherst must volunteer to tutor in a local high school. Orwellian newspeak has become so common in academia that apparently no one sees the irony in the notion that a student must volunteer. Trendy colleges and high schools across the country are requiring service to the community as ways of earning academic credit or even as a precondition for receiving a diploma. In Washington, national service is now in vogue, another feel-good idea financed with other people's money. What is truly frightening is the casual ease with which so many people believe that they can define what is and is not a service to the society. Stanford University's law school, for example, sends students and others over to the nearby ghetto in East Palo Alto to fight against the expulsion of hoodlums from the public school system there. It would be hard to imagine a greater disservice to the black community than allowing their children's education to be disrupted, undermined, or destroyed by troublemakers, thugs, and young drug dealers who want to remain classified as students only so that they can remain on campus and sell crack. We all know what road is paved with good intentions. Whether students working in a soup kitchen or a homeless shelter or doing any of the other services being performed for academic credit are in fact making society better or worse on net balance is an open question, not a foregone conclusion. When weighing the immediate benefits against the promotion of dependency and the enlargement of an army of idle people on the streets, creating more than their share of mischief and crime, the net balance is at least debatable. But even if we assume that every service performed by students is in fact a service, that still leaves the very large question as to why it should be performed by students. No doubt rescuing people from burning buildings would be a service, but do we want students to do it, or is this something we want left to professionally trained fire departments? Even where students have the necessary skills, is there no value to their time in doing what they are in school?